and welcome to Minute 168 of the Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into the Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me on this very special week where we're talking with people who have connections with the real escape is Jonathan Vance, professor of history, POW nerd, and all-around knowledgeable person about the Stalag Luft III. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thanks very much, Rob. It's good to be here with you.
Yeah. I've been looking forward to having this discussion with you for many weeks, months, however you want to look at it, or minutes, mm-hmm. You can even say, because I've been fascinated to hear that you actually wrote a book about the escape. So we'll get to that a little later in this episode, where you'll be able to tell us some interesting things that you found out about mm-hmm. the escape itself. Maybe we'll talk about the differences between the movie and the escape, the original escape, based from a historical perspective. You know, from someone who actually has done the research, unlike me, who's just winging it and just...
I am at your service, Rob.
All right. So Minute 168 begins with Ramsey continuing to answer queries of the numerous POWs that have now been returned to the camp, and ends with Strachwitz looking at the staff car and then looking at the office where Von Luger is and looking back and forth and whatever. So we'll get to that at the end of the minute. We'll explain what that is. So basically what we left off yesterday was that Henley and a number of the other POWs, the only other one that we actually can recognize by name is Nemo. So the two of them are standing in front of all the other returned escapees. I think, if I remember correctly, there are 11 that we can see, or maybe it's 13. I don't remember offhand right now the exact number of what we discussed yesterday. They're having a discussion with Ramsey, who is informing them of the tragedy that has befallen 50 of their comrades who unfortunately didn't make it back. So yesterday we left it off that they started asking about different people. They were asking about Roger, and they were informed that Roger didn't make it. And then this minute actually begins with Nemo asking, what about Haynes? Now, I found that very interesting because this, when I started doing this project, before I did this project, I wasn't able to recognize the difference between Nemo and some of the other prisoners mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And while I've been going through this, I've noticed that he and Haynes were always together. The two of them yep. did a lot of things together. They even escaped together. We saw them on the train together. So what really surprised me is that the character of Nemo, they actually somehow found a way to split them up without showing us what happened to them along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're great friends through the movie and as was the case in reality, separated sometime after they were captured. And one survived, one didn't, which is not unusual at all given the real circumstances.
Yes, right. I mean, you probably know better than I would if there was any rhyme or reason for the decisions of who they shot and who they sent back. I mean, in the movie, what my understanding is that they decided to, you know, let all the American actors stay alive. Mm-hmm. Or most of them, at least.
It seems to have been an equally random reason. They were chosen... entirely randomly. Although, with the exception of Big X, he was probably condemned from the beginning. And the French, Scheidhauer, the Frenchman he escaped with. But literally, it was just the luck of the draw, whether your prisoner ID card got put in one pile or another pile.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's right. But I mean, I wonder if they even tried to film a scene showing, you know, the two of them actually getting captured, and then we could see, you know, what they did wrong in order to get captured.
Yeah.
That would have been interesting because of the fact that they're pretty much the only two recognizable prisoners that they didn't show what happened to them after they made the escape. I mean, we saw with
Cedric and stuff.
You can't show everybody.
The filmmakers were faced with a huge task. And I think one of the great triumphs of the film is that they've combined and condensed a whole bunch of different individual people's experiences into a handful of central characters.
No question about that.
As you say, there's a lot of escapers and you can't follow everybody. But what they did was created these composite characters that bring in a little bit from four or five different people. And so you learn a lot more about many more people's experiences than just the number of key characters there are, which is a real, it's a tricky thing to do.
I mean, I'm sure putting this movie together was not simple from a script perspective. I mean, the rumors, you know, about how difficult it was for Sturgis to actually sell the idea of getting a movie made about an escape where everyone gets caught, you know, or almost everybody gets caught.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't sound like a winning idea first.
But it is. That's the irony of it all.
Yeah.
You know, who would have thought that or besides Sturgis, that such an idea would have actually worked so well?
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, one of the things also that I heard that Sturgis did was the way that he built up the story was it was done in building blocks so that you couldn't take one part out because then it would all tumble down. Everything was based on other aspects of the story. I mean, there's an anecdote that I've heard in the past, and I might have mentioned it in a previous episode, but the fact that at one point they told Sturgis that the movie was a little too long and he had to cut a scene. So they told him to cut the scene out with Griffith showing Roger all the different tailoring things that he was able to do in the movie. You know, he says, okay, we can make vests and we can do this and we take the blankets and we make the way that he explained the whole thing. And so he cut that scene out. And then he showed he had a screening for a whole bunch of executives. And at the end, two executives came over to him and said, wow, this was such a great movie. But explain to me, where did they get the clothes that they were wearing when they made the escape? Uh-huh. So at that point, Sturgis went back to whichever executive told him that he needed to cut it out. And he said, I'm putting it back in.
I told you so.
Exactly.
I mean, you're absolutely right. It's a remarkably well-made film because there are all these things. You come to a scene in minute 10 and you think, why is that in there? And then you get to minute 100 and you say, oh, that's why I was there, because it makes sense. So it really and doing it minute by minute, you can see how much really important stuff is packed into what is. You might call unfairly a fairly traditional action movie.
Exactly. I wouldn't call it a fairly traditional, but I understand why you would say that. That's fine. I'm not offended by that.
Yeah, I think that's how he sold it. I mean, after The Magnificent Seven, which I happened to watch on this weekend, this past weekend, in some ways he sold it as Magnificent Seven Part Two.
Well, he used pretty much the same cast. So
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, in this minute that we're looking at here, there's a couple of really brief exchanges that have behind them a massive amount of historical content, and Sturgis is able to put them across in a flash, which is astonishing.
Right. So we continue with the conversation between Ramsey and the other prisoners. So you know, Nimmo asked about Haynes, and he goes, "Yes, I'm sorry. You know, Haynes was not the one who made it," which. It shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that the character of Haynes didn't make it because he was walking around in a German uniform, which, from what I understand, and you would know this probably better from a historical perspective, that was, a no-no. If you got caught wearing a German uniform and not being a German, you would be shot as a spy.
Yeah, it was, but that was one – there was one escaper who went out in German uniform. Polish airman who had spoke perfect German. And his thinking was that he could travel north to the Baltic. His sister was living in the Baltic coast. And he could eat and stay in soldiers' hostels along the way. So he was in his German uniform. And I don't think that he was executed. I don't think that was what cost him his life. I think it was the fact that he was Polish. But people thought he was crazy. But... it was it worked for him until something entirely unrelated got him recaptured.
Then Ramsey says that Roger's idea was to get back at the enemy the hardest way he could, mess up the works. From what we've heard, I think he did exactly that, which is what you just mentioned. That's such a great line because it really encapsulates the whole essence of this movie about what they were trying to do. And despite this tragedy of losing 50 of the prisoners, they still know that they accomplished what they were trying to do, open up another front.
Yeah, and I, over the years, I talked to a lot of survivors of the Great Escape when they were still around. A lot of people who lost their fathers and brothers and husbands and close friends. And the one question we always got around to is, I think the question that Henley asked, was it worth it? And I can see that if you, and some ex-prisoners are livid about the fact that it was allowed to occur at that time of the war. And obviously, if you lost a loved one in the escape, you have a particular view of it. But I think there's no question that it had a catastrophic impact on the Nazi state.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it went all the way to Hitler for him to make the decision to he wanted to execute them all. And they had to convince him.
All the way to Hitler, and that very morning. So a few hours after the tunnel was found, it was known at the very highest levels of German command. And it created a rift between different parts of the Nazi hierarchy that really never healed. So certainly those 50 deaths were... In a kind of cold accounting sense, they were certainly worth it.
Right.
I mean, 50 is what, 7 Lancaster crews, 7 bomber crews?
It's true.
So not a lot. And they did more to continue the fight than they could ever have imagined. So that's why that scene is really good, because of that kind of philosophical.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, when in Brickhill's book, he mentions the fact that based on the figures that they were able to put together, they assumed that there were about 5 million Germans that spent some of their time looking for these prisoners, and that thousands of them were on the job full-time for weeks. So if that's the case, they definitely got that. I mean, think about it. 5 million German troops were searching for these 76 prisoners. I mean, that's astounding.
And these were guys who could have been doing something useful.
Thankfully, they weren't.
Yeah. So, yeah, within a few hours, they had mobilized about 70,000 auxiliaries on the morning of the 25th. And then they just kept piling on the numbers to try and so eventually, by a week later, when there's still just 2 guys outstanding, these 2 guys are being pursued by that time, probably 3.5 million German police and soldiers. And they're just 2 guys. That's a pretty effective use of manpower.
Or a pretty effective misuse of manpower.
Misuse of manpower.
I wouldn't necessarily say that's a good use of it, but yeah, you're 100% right about that. I mean, and then, you know, we could debate for a very long time the philosophical aspects of whether it was worth it or not. I mean, that's essentially the continuation of the conversation between Henley and Ramsey, where Henley basically asks Ramsey if he thinks it was worth the price, and Ramsey says, "Well,
exactly.
That all depends on your point of view."
Yeah. So if you lost your husband or your father or your son, you're going to have one point of view. If like me, you can be a historian and kind of sit in your objectiveness, you have another answer. But yeah, you're quite right. It's a discussion that'll go on ad infinitum.
Yeah, exactly. No question. Because the problem also is we would never know what the other path would have been. Meaning, had they not, it's the same question that we can always ask when you're talking about history or when you're talking about a movie or life or anything like that. You know, what if you take the other path? You know, the road not taken or whatever. How much will it make a difference? I mean, Robert Frost said it will make a difference, but you know, we don't know. We'll never know. It's the same thing when
we'll never know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's same thing when you're driving somewhere and you're using some sort of GPS, and the GPS tells you to turn one way, and you say to yourself, "Well, I usually go on this road," but you'll never know which decision was the better decision, which was the more efficient decision because you've made your decision and you've moved along in that direction, whichever it is.
Mm-hmm. And everything from that point changes.
Correct. Which is why I love time travel movies that talk about these type of things. But, you know, the Great Escape is not a time travel movie.
Not a time travel.
Well, it is. It is because it takes us back to a different time and place to try to give us a perspective of something that most people will never experience in their lives.
Yeah.
So in some ways, movies are time travel. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why some of the details. That's why it's important to have the scene in where the making of the clothing is made,
right?
Because it's a kind of a response to extraordinary circumstances that is impressive and interesting to think about.
Right. No question about that. And
so, and the movie is filled with those scenes. But this one here, I think what's neat is that Sturgis and James Clavell, the screenwriter, have in a couple of lines of dialogue, maybe 4 or 5 seconds, have opened up this really big philosophical question that people connected to the escape have been talking about and thinking about for decades. And with just those 2 or 3 lines of dialogue, he's able to suggest all of the different elements of it. I think that's brilliant.
No question about that. I completely agree with you. Now, in the original script, I was able to get a copy of the original script that James Clavell wrote in, I think it was April of 62. Yeah, the 26th mm-hmm. of April of 62. So a lot was changed between this script and the final release of the film. Mm-hmm. But there's something that I find pretty essential that they cut out, that ever since I read this a few months ago, I've been disappointed about the fact that they left it out of the movie, or that it got cut out in the end. I mean, basically the conversation with Henley continues at this point. He starts asking where are all the Germans, you know, where's von Luger, mm-hmm. where's Werner, where's Strachwitz? And the response is they've all been sent to the Eastern Front. So, I mean, again, we're jumping a little ahead because, you know, tomorrow we'll talk more about what actually happened to von Luger in the movie. But mm-hmm. I find it interesting that they mention that. And then we have Soren come up behind Henley. Soren, to remind everyone, he's another one of the recognizable characters who didn't make it out. He and Goff were the next two to get out when they made the escape. And then they mm-hmm. they rushed back and were, you know, they were the last ones out of the tunnel going backwards, I guess you could say.
Okay.
And so Soren at this point turns to Henley and says, well, I've been appointed the new Big X. There are a few things we'll need. There's a meeting in the library tonight. And Henley says, all right, I'll be there.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
So for me, that line is essential here. And I'm very surprised mm-hmm. that they cut it out, because basically what Soren is saying here is that we've just had this tragedy, but we're continuing. We're not stopping. Mm-hmm. The movie, from now until the end of the movie, it never really brings up the fact that they're going to continue with everything that they've been doing. It makes it, mm-hmm. it leaves it very ambiguous as to, you know, what's going to happen now. Okay, they tried the escape, 76 got out, 50 got killed. We find out that 3 made it out alive.
Yeah.
And then the rest were all brought back. But what happens after that?
You know, what next? Yeah, and, that's a really good point.
And to this small little discussion between Soren and Henley opens up so many possibilities, because they basically say, okay, back to the drawing board. We're going to now try and figure out, because that is, I mean, you can probably attest to this. They didn't stop at this point. They continued trying to get out. I mean, there was a fourth tunnel, George.
Yeah.
So.
Oh yeah, they rebuilt the organization and continued. Now there were the decision had been made that they were not going to do any more big escapes.
Right.
But it was right back to doing what they could in the camp to confound and confuse their captors. Right. Under a new Big X, under a new department head. So yeah, this battle was over, but the war went on.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's a small little scene right at the very end of this script that is also cut out, where they show the new X organization in the library, you know, having their first meeting or whatever it is. Mm. Which, again, just showing a shot of them all in the library again would have changed everything. It would have shown the only way that this movie continues to show hope at the end is the fact that, mm-hmm. you know, Hiltz isn't broken and he's still, you know, throwing the baseball against the wall. And the guard realizes that, you know, he hasn't been able to they haven't been able to break him by capturing him again.
Mm-hmm.
And that mm-hmm. is a great message. There's no question about that. But I think it would have been even more effective had they shown them reorganizing the X organization.
Yeah, and getting ready to continue the fight.
Yeah, but we didn't get to choose these things. That's all up to Sturgis and everyone else. You know, almost 60 years ago, whatever they decided to do, we're not going to be able to change that. And as I've said many times, I would never want them to remake this movie, because there's no need. It's a near perfect movie as is.
Exactly. Yeah, I'll agree with you on that. Would have been a neat scene to have left in. The part about the dialogue where he asks about the what happened to the various Germans, I actually think is beautifully handled in the film is, because you see, so there's this exchange between Ramsey and Henley, and then the new commandant's car comes up, and this is, I think, the second scene of this minute that speaks volumes without saying volumes.
Yeah, I mean the minute that we got here is basically two very small scenes that say so much.
Yeah.
Henley then walks away, and we see him. He looks as if he's pondering the question that Ramsey has given him about whether it was worth it or not.
Mm-hmm.
We see a German staff car show up. We see SS officer Steinach sitting in the car, which, to remind everyone, he was the one who actually caught Bartlett a few, I think, 2 weeks ago. And he was also there in Gestapo office with Priesen, the other German, the other Nazi that I always forget his name, Dietrich. I don't know why. For some reason, I always think of him as Kramer. I don't know why.
Okay.
It's Dietrich.
Dietrich, exactly. Yes.
So Dietrich and Priesen, he's there with them. He actually now comes to the camp. He's in this staff car. He stands up from the car, looks around. They open the car seat for him in order for him to get out from the back seat. Then he gets out, and he walks towards the commandant's office and enters into the office. And then the door slams closed. And then we see Strachwitz run up and go up the steps towards the entrance of the commandant's office. And then he's about to get to the door, and then you see him hesitate.
Yeah.
And then he starts looking around at all the other guards around there, and then that's basically the end of this minute, where he's still pondering what to do.
So that's that's such a key scene. Again,
yes.
Tons of stuff in a few seconds, because in the historical sense, the escapes from prison camps had been an increasing problem through 1943. And the German police organization, the RSHA, had been angling for ages to take over. I mean, they already ran the concentration camps. They've been angling to take over the prison camps, making the argument that, well, we're the ones who are responsible for looking for these guys when they escape. If we ran the camps, they wouldn't escape in the first place. So they've been pushing and pushing and pushing to take over the prison camps, and were resisted by the army members Keitel and Goering. But the escape and the aftermath is brings the change. That is when the camps are turned over to the SS. And it's kind of the pinnacle of this power struggle between the old military members of the Nazi hierarchy and the police and security members. So Strachwitz pauses on the porch there and looks back, and it's like he's seeing his world has changed, because he's Luftwaffe, he's the old army, the old military. He's just been bypassed, and the SS has breezed in and have taken over the show now. And that moment, which I don't think probably no POWs at the time realized, represents the one of the critical outcomes of the escape, this changeover from military to security command, which, I mean, it could have been catastrophic. It just so happened that the person put in charge of the camps on the SS end was that rarity, a decent SS officer, Gottlob Berger, who in fact ran the camps well and relatively humanely, but it could have gone very badly for the prisoners. But certainly that one scene, a few seconds of that scene, you see the change of the old world giving way to the new world, and the SS is now in charge, and end of story. So it's a great little scene.
Well, all right, now I'm going to actually ask you a question that we discussed months and months and months ago on the show, when we were trying to figure things out about the difference between the camp being run by the Luftwaffe or being run by the SS or being run by the Gestapo, whatever. I mean, we found it very strange, the fact that the Germans decided that the people who are going to be in charge of the Air Force prisoners are the Air Force, the Luftwaffe. And then, you know, the different camps will be run by the same branch of the prisoners. Mm-hmm. So is that something I mean, I've never heard of that type of thing before. I mean, you never hear in an American military prison that they have, or possibly even in a Canadian one, where they will have, okay, you're in an Air Force prison, or you're in a Marine prison, or you're in an Army prison, or a Navy prison, whatever. Everyone's thrown together, aren't they?
Exactly. Yeah, this is a uniquely German solution in the Second World War to allow each of the services to take care of its own prisoners. And it has good things and bad things about it. If you happen to be a naval prisoner, your war is actually quite pleasant because the Kriegsmarine, the German Navy, has so few prisoners. There's one camp, and it's quite decent. If you're on the other end with the army, then you're amongst the most numerous group. Your fortunes are a little more dire. But I think it's a result of the historic independence of the three services in Germany. And the degree to which, even in 1939, each of the services had enough power to
demand,
kind of make the argument for keeping their own.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's actually very fascinating.
Now, as I say, as of the summer of 1944, that changes, but still, most prisoners wouldn't have recognized the change.
Did it change across the board, or it only changed in this in Stalag Luft 3?
Changed across the board. The entire German prison camp structure became under the control of the SS, the Reichsmarine Security Office.
And then they mixed the prisoners up, because, like you just mentioned earlier,
they
you
left mentioned everything that the naval, the same.
Right, because you said the naval prisoners were in a relatively decent camp because there weren't that many of them.
Yeah.
So they still stayed in that under those same conditions at that point.
They stayed there, and their commandant was a former U-boat captain, and their guards were Navy men. It's just that the next level of command above them was the SS.
Right.
So, yeah, it makes for a strange kind of camp system, and terribly inefficient.
But. Apparently. I mean, we've discussed this throughout this entire podcast about how inefficient it is to put all of your rotten eggs in one basket if you don't have a good enough security system around that. You know, because, mm-hmm. you know, they had people escaping, you know, in twos and threes up until then. And here you put everyone together and then you get this major breakout because you basically put all of your escape artists together.
Yeah.
So.
And I mean, it would have been different if they had had an entire staff of expert, experienced security guards. But aside from the ferrets, people like Werner, the guards are kind of overage, unfit, uninterested, uncommitted, 50, 60-year-olds, not the best jailers for these young, enthusiastic, bright, smart, energetic young guys.
Makes you wonder why they made the decision like that.
I mean, I think it was desperation. They had tried, in the beginning of the war, they tried to put their troublemakers in each of their camps, parcel them out, but that just meant they had every camp became a problem. So they figured, well, that didn't work, so let's take all the rotten eggs, and as the commandant says in the film, let's take all the rotten eggs and put them in one basket. I mean, I suppose from their perspective, it was worth a try because the status quo wasn't working.
Okay, so we've been talking about the history or whatever. So what's your history with both this movie and with the idea of POWs during World War II? Like, what got you involved in this whole thing? You know, we don't have 6 hours to talk about it, but
no, I shall make this brief.
No, but it fascinates me, and I'm sure our listeners also would be interested to know. You know, why would someone choose to go into a career like this?
Yeah, well, it started off accidentally. My mother read all these books, so I remember them lying around the house when I was a kid, and when I was probably 10 or 11, the movie came on TV, and she said, "Oh, you should watch that. I've read the book. It's an interesting film." So I watched it. It happened to be broadcast on Victoria Day, which in Canada is a great holiday, and there's always fireworks on Victoria Day evening. And every Victoria Day, my sister and I would and our friends would get onto the park to watch the fireworks. And I started watching this film, and as soon as the music came up, I was hooked. And I remember I was sitting upstairs in my parents' bedroom with my eyes glued to the TV, and my sister was downstairs yelling at me to come to the fireworks. And I was not moving until the film was over. I was transfixed. So from that point, I became weirdly obsessed, as teenagers sometimes do. And I started to get in touch with ex-prisoners, and they were remarkably tolerant with this geeky Canadian kid.
With a 10-year-old kid getting in touch with them.
They invited me to their homes to meet them, to their reunions. I traveled around Canada and the UK talking to them.
Well, as a kid you traveled into the UK?
Yeah.
Wow.
My parents took me so we could meet some of these people.
When was this? This was the late 70s, early 80s?
This would have been 73, 74, 75, around there.
Uh-huh. Okay. Wow.
So, and at that time in the 70s, a lot of the key players were still alive. People who were deeply involved in the escape. One of the first guys I met was a guy named Harry Day, who was a legendary escaper, who was a wonderful guy. And so by the time I actually realized you could do serious research on this, I had really good connections in the XLOF 3 community.
Wow.
And then I decided, well, you know, I maybe I should do something, so I'll write a book about it. And I spent years tracking down the not only the survivors, but the families of those who were killed. And so I went around the world to see them and interview them and get their story and find out about their relatives. And that eventually was produced the book I wrote. Originally called A Gallant Company, and later I think it's The True Story of the Great Escape. So at some point I realized that what was a childhood hobby you could actually turn into a job.
Yeah,
and actually, I was hugely lucky to be able to become a professional historian and get paid to do what I would do otherwise as a hobby.
Yeah, for sure.
So
wow, that is so fascinating. Now wait, so your PhD thesis is also about the Great Escape, or that you chose something else?
It's about it's more about the aid campaign for prison camps, the International Red Cross and philanthropic organizations.
Mm, okay, we had an episode months ago that we talked all about that, about all the different things that the Red Cross was able to smuggle into.
Exactly.
Into the camp.
But
we talked immensely about all the different sports. I found an article about sports in the prison camps, and it was just astounding to read how many different baseball teams and football teams and basketball teams they had just in Stalag-Luf 3.
They had
200 baseball teams or something like that.
And they had a full theater and orchestra, and it was remarkable. But that research actually brought me a curious connection to this film, which was a real surprise. I did my PhD at York University in Toronto in the 90s, and one of my professors was a guy named Michael Cater, who does German history, wonderful historian, and a really good guy. And as I was finishing the program, he came up to me and said, "Look, I'm going to be on your dissertation examining committee," and which seemed odd to me. And he said, "You know why, don't you?" And he had this big smile on his face. He said, "Because I was in The Great Escape." And so I talked to him about it. And so in this scene that begins with Hendley and Nimmo, you see the ranks of prisoners behind there. So they're all students at Heidelberg University in Germany. And Michael Cater was an undergraduate when the film was being made. And they got an invitation from the filmmakers for all the young men in Heidelberg University to go out to the film site on these days and be extras in this film. And so his connection to the film was being one of the massive prisoners who were in the background.
Wait, not one of the ones who came back, one of the ones that were already there, right?
He's just a face in the crowd.
Are you able to point to him? Are you able to see him? Or
no, because his one great tragedy, he told me this, he was he was given the uniform of a Rhodesian airman. So RAF blue, but the Rhodesia shoulder tab. And there was, he had one scene in which he appeared with, I think it was with James Garner. And but he was saddened that the scene never made it to the film. It ended up on the cutting room floor.
Oh,
so
wow.
The only time when we could actually see him in the film was edited out, which was very, I thought was very sad for Michael. However, it's interesting to know that everyone in the background are all the extras are German university students.
Wow. And that's amazing that you know, luck of the draw gave you this particular minute where he apparently is there.
Exactly.
You know.
Yeah, exactly. Weirdest thing, so.
Yeah. Well, fate.
But I would love to have seen his one scene.
Yeah. I don't think it'll be possible to try and find that edited out scene. That would be amazing if we were able to find some of those.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, it just goes to show you there are weird connections all over the place.
For sure. Wow. Okay. Do you have any other interesting tales about either the movie or The Real Escape that you think our listeners might want to hear about?
I got millions of tales, Rob, but
Not millions.
It won't go on forever.
No, well, you know, we'll let people, you know, get in touch with you if they want to afterwards, you know. To sit and pick your brain, that would be great.
I mean, the thing, I love the film. I mean, and I can accept the historical inaccuracies, which are, of which there are many. The one thing that I think is really neat about it is the physical reconstruction of the camp itself, which was done with enormous care and sensitivity. So despite the fact that all of the actors look a little too healthy to be prisoners, and the sun's always shining a little too much, and it's always a little too pleasant temperature, when you see the film, you're seeing a remarkably accurate reconstruction of what the camp looked like. And I think that's a terrific achievement for Sturgis to have brought in to the set people who were there in 1943 and 44 to say, look, that's wrong. You should make that way. Change these bunks, move that door to the other side, et cetera, et cetera. He had Wally Floody on site there to correct any errors that came up in the set construction, which I think is beautiful like this. So maybe that's my favorite thing about the film, is that it is a kind of time capsule. You're going back to 1963, but you're also going back to 1943.
Right.
And seeing the environment that these young men lived in, I think that's a remarkable achievement.
Yeah, were you ever able to meet Wally Floody?
Oh yeah, Wally Floody was a remarkable fellow, huge, big bear of a guy. His lungs had been largely ruined by digging tunnels, and smoking, of course, but the digging tunnel didn't help.
Yeah.
He was a gregarious, delightful, big-hearted guy. Couldn't do enough for you, as a lot of these fellows were. They were. It was terrific to meet this generation, even if they were in their declining years at that time. And Floody was one of the giants, physically as well as kind of emotionally.
Wow. Okay. Very interesting. And I wanted to also ask him.
I mean, it was great because the survivors, I talked to almost all the survivors of the escape, and they tended to have a remarkable outlook because they believed that they, when they were shot down, they cheated death for the first time. And when they escaped and survived, they cheated death for the second time. And so they tended to see all of their life after 1944 as a remarkable gift that they had been given through sheer good fortune, and it was amazing to see them. I saw the one of the Norwegians who escaped successfully to Sweden. A lot of guys who were recaptured 10 miles from the camp in the snow 12 hours later. And they all have this incredible zest for life because I think they realized they had been given a second and a third chance, and they made the most of it, which was really neat.
Wow. Yeah, I think that is a great message from them, you know, to live your life to the fullest, even after these type of things.
And then there was one guy who had been, he had been shot down 3 times, I think, and after he was demobilized in 1945, he never flew again because he figured he'd used up all his luck in the air. So he never flew. He lived till he was 90 or something, and if he couldn't get there by train, he wasn't going.
Wow.
I can see that, too.
Yeah. How many Canadians were...
There were 9 Canadians in the escape who actually got out of the camp. 6 of them were executed, and the other 3 I was in touch with, and one of them was the fellow who was Tommy Thompson, who was captured in the right at the beginning of the war. So he was a prisoner from September 1939 until May 1945.
Wow.
And this was just one of his escapes. He actually met Hermann Göring early in his captivity because he was one of the first, he and his pilot, one of the first prisoners shot down.
He wasn't a pilot?
He was an observer, I think. Mm. His pilot survived too. His pilot was in the camp. You see him in the books. His name was Murray, Wank Murray. And they were taken over for an audience with Hermann Göring because he was tickled to meet some of these early prisoners. And he was also interested in Canadian ice hockey. So he wanted to meet a Canadian. But that actually reminds me of another point that I wanted to squeeze in that I thought about earlier. And that was when this is where the aftermath of the escape kind of boggles the imagination. So one of the reasons why the military was so opposed to these executions was because of their kind of very traditional understanding of military honor. And they didn't want the blood of these prisoners on their hands. Now, keep in mind, the army is responsible for untold atrocities. Everywhere that they went. So it's not like the army has clean hands. But if you look at what Hermann Göring said, the head of the Luftwaffe, Keitel, the head of the OKW, the military high command, other guys who were of the old military school, these are people who were implicated in atrocities of terrifying extent. The one thing that bothers them in 1945 when they faced the war crimes trials, the one thing that bothers them is the execution of these 50 airmen.
They knew that this was unjustified?
Because it violated their military honor, their old code of honor. So slaughtering civilians in Russia, it happens. Laying waste to villages of resistors, horrific acts of violence. They look past that, but to execute these 50 Air Force officers, that's the what Göring says, this is the one thing I knew I was going to pay for. He figures that he's brought up to Nuremberg for this crime alone. All the other stuff he doesn't care about, but this thing is what bothers him. I think that's quite astonishing.
Yeah, seriously. Wow.
It points out the really twisted values of these individuals, that this was the one thing that kept them awake at night.
Yeah. Well, at least something kept them awake. It means that as Muncher says they were, they still had a conscience somewhere, despite the fact that they turned it off, you know.
And it seems that we talked about the aftermath and who did the choosing of the names. It seems that the police official who actually made the choices, looking at the identification photos of the individuals, it seems that he was so disturbed by that. This was a man who was, again, implicated in all sorts of other atrocities, but not in a personal sense. It seems that he was so bothered by this that he eventually joined the July plot against Hitler. And was executed for turning against the regime that had created him. So, again...
Wow.
Was it worth it? Yeah, I think it definitely was.
Yeah, basically sounds that way. All right, now one last thing I wanted to ask you as a Canadian. Mm-hmm. Okay, now the character of Haynes is supposed to be Canadian, and you know a lot has been said about the fact that James Coburn gives a terrible Australian accent. Now the question is do you think that Lawrence Mont I always have trouble pronouncing his last name. Forgive me, anyone who's listening who knows him. Okay, so Lawrence Montaigne, I think his name was, who played Haynes. What did you think about his Canadian accent where he would throw in his a boot?
I think it's kind of cute. I don't know about anything else about his background, but I think it's kind of cute. Because it's, I mean, when you make a film like this, it's about identifiable characteristics, stereotypical characteristics. And how more stereotypical than the Canadians going oot and a boot?
That's right. I mean, I grew up in Detroit, so I'm very familiar. I'm familiar with it.
You understand how we talk, so.
I had classmates from Windsor. We knew how to, we knew how to make fun
of
them.
You know how to interpret them. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, make fun of them and interpret them at the same time. Very good. This has been so enlightening and so fascinating. I've learned a lot. Hopefully all of our listeners have also learned many new things from you. Do you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you if they're interested? How can they find you?
If anyone wants to get in touch with me, you can reach me at the University of Western Ontario, where I teach. All my contact information, email, mailing address, telephone is on the History Department website. You can find all. I'm happy to answer any questions, because this is the first project that I did as a historian, and it's the one that's still sticks with me, so I can't get enough of it.
Seriously, almost 50 years you've been dealing with the Great Escape, and that's just an amazing, amazing that you were able to turn this hobby into a profession and still enjoy it and get paid for it.
I'm forever grateful for that opportunity.
Yeah, you have to say thank you to your mother who sent you to her room to watch the movie.
Exactly.
Go to your room and watch this movie. We all wish.
And she launched me on a career, so right. Perfect.
That's very true. All right. Well, while you're doing that, you go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher that you might be using to listen to this show. You can contact us. Our website is thegreatescapeminute.com. Our email address is thegreatminute@gmail.com. Our Facebook group is The Cooler, and our Twitter account is GreatEscapeMXM. So until tomorrow, when we will have another special guest, tally-ho!
Tally-ho!